the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. And next hour, my growing fascination continues with underground and underwater bases with guest Richard Sauter. Get ready for that one. Here's some stories of the day. Well, you might have seen him on national television tonight, capping the end of a 60-day nationwide tour to promote changes to the Social Security system. President Bush on Thursday night repeated many of the proposals that he made on the road, emphasizing both personal investment accounts and benefits to personal income. In a primetime address to the nation, Bush also chastised anyone in Congress who would try to cast the Social Security debate in a political light. This is what he said. I'm willing to listen to any good idea from either party, adding that if Congress can set aside politics, then Republicans and Democrats will be able to stand together and take credit for doing what is right for our children and grandchildren. Bush said that a hole in the safety net has been created because Congresses have made promises they cannot keep for younger generations. He pledged that all Americans born before 1950 will receive full benefits. He also proposed that benefits for low-income workers will rise more quickly than for people who are better off. And thirdly, he said he wants to give young workers the option of investing their Social Security taxes into personal accounts. What happens here is anyone's guess. A military jury has sentenced a soldier to death for a grenade and rifle attack on his own comrades during the opening days of the Iraq invasion, a barrage that killed two officers and what prosecutors say was driven by religious extremism. Sergeant Hassan Akbar, who gave a brief apology hours earlier, stood at attention between his lawyers as the verdict was delivered. He showed no emotion. He could have been sentenced to life in prison or with or without parole for the early morning March 2003 attack, which also wounded 14 fellow members of the Army's 101st Airborne Division at Camp Pennsylvania in Kuwait. A bizarre story. You'll have to hear this one. Fishermen claim to have spotted a creature resembling a human in the Caspian Sea. A captain of a trawler told an Iranian newspaper the creature was swimming a parallel course near the boat for a long time. At the beginning, he says, we thought it was a big fish, but then we spotted hair on the head of the monster, and his fins looked pretty strange. The front of his body was equipped with arms. According to the paper, the man of the sea has been spotted with increasing regularity since offshore production began in the Caspian. Eyewitnesses say the marine humanoid is about 5 feet 6 inches, strong built, with a protruding stomach, webbed hands, and black-green hair. His lower lip is said to join smoothly to his neck above his gills. That's a strange creature. Story we continue to report on, those toads that have been exploding. Why are the toads puffing up and spontaneously exploding in northern Europe? It began in Germany, then it spread into Denmark. Well, a scientist now says that he believes it could be crows. That's what's happening. He thinks the crows know how to peck at the toads, get to their livers, and it's giving the perception that the toads are exploding. But I don't know. So far, they found 1,000 just near one pond. I don't think you have enough crows to do that at one time. A South African farmer and one of his employees were found guilty of murder for attacking a farm worker with machetes and throwing him into a lion enclosure, bringing to a climax a case that rattled the country in South Africa. Long accustomed to violence and crime, the two men said they were innocent. Then they tried to blame each other. Apparently, they beat up a man with machetes, tied him up, and then tossed him into a reserve for lions in a nearby village, tossed over a fence. A scientist and former U.S. Department of Agriculture inspector is claiming the government covered up mad cow disease years before a case even turned up in Canada. Lester Friedlander says he was forced out of his job as head of inspections at a large Philadelphia meatpacking plant in 1995 after blowing the whistle on what he called unsafe practices. In a moment, we will talk with Dr. Lester Friedlander, DVM, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
This hour of Coast to Coast AM is brought to you by United Healthcare. It just makes sense.
Dr. Lester Friedlander was once the chief USDA meat inspector at the largest hamburger processing plant in the country, and he boasts immaculate credentials as an expert on the workings of the U.S. meat industry. Having spent countless thousands of hours on the slaughterhouse killing floor amidst countless thousands of carcasses designed for dinner plates across America, Dr. Friedlander is now a strict vegetarian and an outspoken critic of the U.S. meat industry. This drastic turnaround came to Dr. Friedlander after seeing too many animals cruelly mishandled and tormented at slaughter, too many missteps in the inspection process, and too many slip-ups, sacrificing both human and animal welfare. After revealing the secrets of the USDA's meat inspection process on national television, the USDA handed him his walking papers. Now he spends his day speaking out about the drastic shortcomings in the federal food inspection system in hopes of enlightening the public, you, and ultimately reforming the agriculture business, the cruel, as he says, agriculture business machine. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome to the show. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, too. Let's go back just a little bit, 1995, when you are the head of inspections at a large Philadelphia meat plant. Tell me, what was going on at that time, Lester?
Well, back in 1995, I was actually forced out of my job in April 21st of 1995. I was in charge of the largest hamburger plant in the country. We slaughtered over 1,800 cows a day, and it was north of Philadelphia, here in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And then they just gave me my walking papers on, it was August 28th of 1992, and told me today they were going to reassign me, and they gave me no reason for it. So like a good soldier, I took the orders, and I took the reassignment. And then what happened was they gave me five small plants of what we call a mini circuit. And while I was at those five small plants, my key plant was actually a veal plant.
Well, what kind of plant is that?
Veal.
Oh, yeah. Veal plant. Okay.
Yeah. And then I was only there for a short period of time, and I saw something drastically wrong, that the animals were actually on steroids. What we call a beta agonist called clenbuterol.
Yeah. When you were monitoring this, yeah, in some of the unsafe practices that you saw, you of course you were a whistleblower. Now tell me, who did you tell, did it fall on deaf ears? And then this is when they decided to move you out.
Well, yeah. Every time I've been on national TV, probably a dozen times or more. And that includes from doing an interview with Dateline NBC,
mm-hmm.
48 Hours on CBS, Hard Copy, Primetime Live on ABC, CBS Evening News. And every time they interviewed me here in Pennsylvania, the producers went to Washington, D.C. to talk to my bosses. And they would tell my bosses, we just got done talking to Dr. Lester Friedlander in Pennsylvania, and he said this. And every time, my bosses would say they had no comment.
All right, what are some of the things you told the media, Lester?
Well, some of the things I told the media is about, number one, about the hamburger meat, that at that time we were using down cows, non-ambulatory cows, okay, which I consider sick cows. And you got to remember, because they're non-ambulatory, they can't walk. That's the last stage of mad cow disease. So I was telling...
And they were using those cows, they were grinding them up, using them in our food.
All right. Also the federal school lunch program.
Oh, gosh.
And that's when I got on Hard Copy, and that's when I stated on Hard Copy that the meat that's fed to our kids in the federal school lunch program is from diseased animals.
And that's when the USDA went ballistic, huh?
Well, yeah, they went ballistic because what happened the next day, parents all over the country called up the 800 number for USDA and wanted to know if I was telling the truth that down cows, non-ambulatory cows, that were dragged on the ground were used in the school lunch program.
Now, you also claim that you know of some USDA veterinarians who sent suspect cow brains, for example, to private laboratories that confirmed BSE, but that the government laboratories cleared the samples from the same animals. So elaborate on that if you can, Lester.
Okay. That I was misquoted as.
Okay.
Okay, actually what happened was I knew veterinarians that worked for USDA that sent samples to USDA laboratories, and because that the right part of the brain wasn't sent in, that they couldn't test the brain, also parts of the brain were missing. Sometimes they just neglected taking the sample and looking for mere cow disease. And that's, like I said, according to conversations I had with veterinarians working for USDA.
No, but did any of those samples confirm BSE?
No, none of them did.
None did.
No.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty big statement that they misquoted you at, I'm sure.
Well, that's true, but what I said that I would take a polygraph test on is statements that I had first-class knowledge of, first-hand knowledge of, and that was back in 1991. They had a big meeting about mare cow disease in Washington, D.C., and the head pathologist, Dr. Pat McCaskey, who's the branch chief of pathology, they called him into the meeting and asked him if he thought that any veterinarian would ever find mere cow disease in the United States. Dr. McCaskey said that if anybody would ever find it in the United States, it would be one person. That would be Dr. Lester Freelander of Pennsylvania. Now, they asked McCaskey, what would you say, Dr. Freelander? And he told them basically that I started in 1985. In 1987, they started the first year training new veterinarians. And they made me a veterinary trainer for the whole Northeast from Maine to Virginia. And in that first year, 1987, with only 2 years experience, I got the award as veterinary trainer of the whole country. And number two is I found a disease in cattle, never documented before, and had it published in the Journal of Veterinary Pathology. Number three, I was given the first camera in USDA to take pictures of live animals and also postmortem carcasses and organs. They have slides made so they can be used at the USDA Training Center at Texas A&M University. So I had all these things going for me. And actually, I have pathology lab reports that I have copies of here with me that back in 1989, I was the only veterinarian and first veterinarian in the United States collecting cow brains on my own. Unfortunately, none of those cow brains I sent into the USDA lab at Athens, Georgia, the Eastern lab, ever came back positive for mere cow disease. It was always something else.
In your opinion, Lester,
yes.
has our government covered up mad cow disease cases, and they just didn't want the public to know about it?
I feel very strongly that that's the case. That you know, you got to put everything in perspective. Like, number one, Canada has 12 million cattle, okay? They already found four cases. Actually, one was the one from Washington State that was traced back to Alberta, okay, back in December 2003. So they had four positives out of 12 million cattle. We've got a total of between 135 and 140 million cattle in the United States, and we can't find one. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, not one.
Not one. Out of 135 to 140 million, but Canada, out of 12 million, look how many they found, four already. Great Britain also has about 12, 13 million. Look how many cases they found.
You don't eat meat anymore, do you?
No.
I don't want to scare a lot of people who do, but what would you say about the state of our meat industry then?
Well, the point is, that I'm trying to make is that USDA should be taken out of meat and poultry inspection, because instead of protecting the consumer like Congress wanted to do after the book The Jungle was written back in like 1906 or 1907, USDA is geared more to protecting the industry. In other words, what the industry wants, USDA gives it to them. Like, for example, faster line speeds to get the job done faster. And that definitely right there puts a disadvantage on USDA inspectors and veterinarians because the cows are going by so fast, and it's very hard to pinpoint any kind of contamination on them.
About 2 years ago, the USDA along with the FDA got together, and they said they were going to change a lot of things to try to minimize the possibility of mad cow disease. They were going to try to stop putting these blood, for example, in the feed and things. I don't think they've stopped anything, have they? Nothing's changed.
No, nothing has changed. And unfortunately, this ban came into effect in 1997, just like in Canada. But still to this day, the General Accounting Office and Office of Inspector General of USDA checked Food and Drug Administration records, and there's still feed mills in this country that are out of compliance with that law. In other words, Pacific Risk Materials, that's spinal cord, dorsal root ganglion, brainstem, eyeballs, tonsils, small intestines, are still found in feed that's labeled from a vegetable source.
Are we getting cases, people coming down with, the human form of mad cow disease?
Well,
is this happening on a regular basis? If so, I mean, we're not hearing a lot of cases. There are some out there, but not a lot.
Right. So far, I think there's only one case that they call V for variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and that's a direct link to irritated meat, okay? But that case they figured out from a lady that spent some time in Great Britain, and that's where she probably got it from. There is other cases of sporadic CJD or clusters that are popping up all around the country that should be investigated.
I guess even if you have one or two cases, that's enough to scare a lot of people, though, isn't it?
Well, I believe just one case is enough to scare you. Even though the former Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Vindman, stated that that the risk is very low, that the American consumer should not worry about mad-cow disease, I say that the risk is so low you can die from it.
Yeah, it just takes a few, doesn't it? We've got 120 million cattle in the United States. Canada has 15 million. What's going to happen at all, Lester, that can help change this to alleviate this potential problem, this fear?
Well, I think what's going to have to happen is that the American consumer was going to have to put more pressure on the Senator and Congress, Congress people, to change the law and get USDA out of meat and poultry inspection. I feel that it should be run by a consumer agency created by Congress, run by medical doctors or veterinarians with masters in public health or PhDs in public health. And when a veterinarian like myself condemns an animal, I don't need any congressman or senator or person from Washington, D.C. calling me up and saying, can't we just save some of it, or can't we save a hindquarter and condemn the rest? If I feel that it's diseased and not wholesome, then the whole carcass should be condemned.
A study by the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis several years ago concluded that there was a 20% chance that mad cow was likely to be found in U.S. cattle. Do you think that's pretty accurate percent, 20%?
I think it's pretty accurate. But like I said, one thing when you talk about, why I feel there's a cover-up, in the record books, there was a case there in Wisconsin with a mink farm in Stetsonville, Wisconsin, back in the late 70s. And Dr. Richard Marsh went and investigated those cases. And what happened was the mink showed signs of central nervous system. They're acting very strange. They're very aggressive. Dr. Marsh went and did the investigation, and he found out from the owner of the mink farm what was the common denominator that could possibly show the signs that these mink were showing. And the thing was that there was a federal plant only several miles away, and the plant, the owner of the mink branch went to that federal plant and got and bought condemned cows, downer cows, non-ambulatory, that were condemned by a USDA veterinarian, and bought those carcasses and ground them up and fed them to the mink, and that's how the mink got what we call transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
Well, and that's got to stop. So what does Lester Friedlander do now? What are you doing?
I'm trying to educate the consumer on what's actually going on behind the closed doors with USDA and the meat packing industry, and also trying to give him a bird's eye view of what I saw while I was working for the department and how the department, like I said, is geared mostly to protect the industry, not the consumer.
Well, keep it up, Lester. Somebody's got to keep an eye on these things. Appreciate you being part of Coast to Coast. I'm going to have open lines for you now when we come right back. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818-501-4721. And our wild card line, 818-501-4109.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505. With George Norrie, call the wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, it sure is. Hey, don't forget to pick up the June edition of the After Dark newsletter. Well, you get 14 for the price of 12, but the June edition is a special UFO edition. It's a collector's item for the summer. You can order by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Well, if you haven't been up to the coasttocoastam.com website yet, take a look at the picture sent in by Don under emails, listeners' emails. He has got a photo of one of these triangular-shaped objects that we've been talking about, and this thing is way up there, but you clearly can see that it's a flying triangle with lights at each corner, at each little point. And go take a look at it. It's a very fascinating photo. To the phones we go. Wild Card Line, get us started. You're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Indianapolis. Well, this is Lawrence.
Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? First-time caller. I used to listen a few years ago and kind of got out of, lost you when I moved from Mississippi and kind of got up with you again.
Well, yeah, we're everywhere, so I'm glad you found us.
All right. I just was going to ask you, you were talking about the creature that was out in the Caspian Sea or wherever, and at a time, you know, we feel like everything's doomed or whatever. I was wondering if you saw where they have found ivory-billed woodpecker again in Arkansas that's supposed to have been extinct since the 1930s or something.
You're absolutely right, and what a remarkable-looking bird that is. And, you know, if there's one, there's got to be two out there somewhere, don't you think?
Even in Mississippi, around some of the big breaks and stuff, you know, hunting when I was growing up and stuff, I would swear I was seeing them and tell people, and they'd say, no, that's something else. But I think there's more of them than what they think there is, and I thought that was a good story, and I didn't know who all had heard it. So.
You know, this is such, Lawrence, a huge planet. I think there are still creatures roaming around this planet, and I'm not talking about deep in the depths of the ocean, but on land that we probably haven't even found yet, and probably big ones, too.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I appreciate you taking my call, and enjoy your show.
Okay, absolutely. Did you see the picture of the 40-million-year-old whale bones that they found in Egypt? That was an incredible story. At one point, you know, unless somebody's playing a game here, and I don't think they were, at one point, that area to sustain a whale must have been an ocean, and it must have been pretty darn deep. And now it's gone. And that, to me, is probably what happened on Mars, too. Same kind of thing. It's all gone. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing,
I'm
George?
Doing great. Where are you calling from, sir?
Okay, this is Jerry, and I'm calling from Tempe, Arizona.
Hey, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Okay, I'd like to comment on the guest that you had yesterday about the secret codes and stuff that he got out of the Mayan and Egyptian.
Yep, Maurice Cotterell.
Right. Okay. I had just finished a book written by Patrick Gurrell and Gino Retinex. It's called The Orion Prophecy, and they must have had some real high computers, because they went back with the star formations like about 100,000 years, and what they did, they got some of the codes from the pyramids, from the Egyptians, and from the Mayans, and one of the durations of one of the great cycles where the Earth actually flips is like about 25,920 years. And somehow they were ever able to set up the star patterns when those flips took place. And their contention is that in 2012, on December 21st to the 22nd, is when the exact same star pattern's going to appear again, and we're in for a flip.
I'm telling you, that is rapidly becoming one of my favorite dates, because I'm hearing all kinds of things. Of course, we heard Maurice last night talking about that, and I've heard that too, like you have, that we're in for a big magnetic flip, and anything could happen. It's going to be a fascinating time, I think, for all of us.
Well, they claim that the you know, all of the Earth's places, tectonic plates, are going to get loose, and we're going to have giant tidal waves. And some of the predictions that I've heard, like from Edgar Cayce, and that what 2/3 of the world's population is supposed to perish, and something like that.
Well, let's sit back and see what happens. That's all we can do.
Grab your bag.
Right? You got it. Or just
okay, George. Let's see. The name of these guys are Patrick Gurrell and Gino Retinex.
Okay.
And maybe you might try to get them together with the guy you had last night.
Okay. Maybe one of our roundtables. Hey, thanks. Appreciate it. And I don't know if you want to grab your bags or just stay pat, because there aren't many places you can go if a lot of things happen. And I just don't know if it does occur, if it's going to be gradual over the next few years that we see these things happening. One would say we're seeing them happen now. Or, you know, are we going to wake up one morning on December 21st, 2012, and bang, it just happens. East of the Rockies, welcome to the program. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Margaret, and I'm calling from WRV in Richmond, Virginia.
Well, welcome to the show, Margaret.
Oh, I love it. You frequently have on the guest Richard C. Hoagland, and
yes,
he often mentions Nikola Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had seen a movie called Coffee and Cigarettes, and it's about 12 vignettes that is centered around drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes.
Coffee and cigarettes? There's a movie on coffee and cigarettes?
Right. It's just like 12 little separate things. And I'm watching a movie, and all of a sudden, they have this one with a guy, Jack and Meg, I can't remember the last name. But he comes, and it's called Tesla. And he comes, Tesla's coil. And he comes out, and they're like in a restaurant smoking and having cigarettes, and he has a wagon with something on it. And she says to him, it's her brother, well, you might as well tell me what it is. And he starts going through the whole thing, and he made it, and he says, well, you know, it turns air into currents, and he invented fluorescent lights and radio and TV and lasers and X-ray. And he goes into the whole thing, and how Earth is a conductor of acoustical resonance. And I said, oh, God, that reminded me of Richard C. Hoagland. And then then he even had a picture, I think, of was him on the wall, because it looked like a man.
They put a picture of Richard on the wall?
Not Richard. I think it could have been Tesla, because there's a big picture above the table, and as a man, it looks like he has headphones on.
I got an email last week from an actor who does a one-person play on Nikola Tesla. And he is coming to Los Angeles in a few months, and that might be kind of interesting to interview him as if you're talking to Tesla.
Oh.
And because he's got it down pat, I guess. He's got his life, what he did, his inventions, and that might be one way of traveling into time to do something like that.
And they had one more thing with him, and it was called Champagne about Tesla. And it was like Bill Rice and Taylor Mead. And they're janitors in an armory, and Taylor says to him, I feel like I'm divorced from the world. And then he says, could you hear it? And then they play Mahler's I've Lost Track of the World in German. And then his brother tells him, yes, the song resonates through the building. And then he starts talking about Tesla again.
Why are you so interested in Tesla?
From your show, it got me interested.
Really?
Yes, and Richard C. Hoagland. And then I had never heard of him before. I guess I went to school.
Well, I'll tell you, you just keep listening. We always talk about him. He's a regular part of this program. Thanks for the call. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George, this is Rick trucking across New Mexico.
Prove it, Rick. Let's honk the horn. There you go. Now we believe you. Of course, we always did, but that just ensures it.
Yeah, but I got a theory that I would like to share with you guys that I've given a lot of thought to.
Okay, what's up?
And that is, I believe that the Iapetus up there.
One of the moons up there of Saturn. Where are you?
I think I lost you.
Oh, I can hear you. You can't hear me. Nope, got to let him go. Oh, well. First-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes.
This is Sam. I'm St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hey, Sam. Listening, no doubt, on KSTP, I bet.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Exactly. You I just it. Moved up here from St. Louis, Missouri.
That's funny. I moved from Minneapolis to St. Louis.
Wow. That's great. Yeah, I got a question for you. I've been doing some thinking about, because I'm into psychology and stuff. I'm 17 years old, by the way.
Are you really?
Yeah.
You don't sound it.
Yeah, I'm a singer, too. People don't think that at all.
What do you sing?
Well, I write my own songs on acoustic and stuff. I'm trying to get somewhere with it.
Good for you. Well, hey, you're only 17. Who knows what's going to happen?
Exactly. I've had a question about, I don't know any blind people, but people that have been blind, like have never seen the light of day in their whole lives, do they have dreams?
Yes, they do. And I've talked to them sometimes. Some of them in their minds believe this they dream in color, even though they have no idea what a color might look like. It's based on their mind. They've created this in their own mind, and it's pretty remarkable. But, yes, they do dream.
Wow. All right, thanks. That's
okay, good luck with your music. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Shiloh out of Zanesville, Ohio.
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad. Well, you pointed this towards the image on your Coast to Coast website there, and I zoomed in real quick and cleared up the photo, and did you happen to notice the other triangular object off in the distance?
Now, hold on now. Now you've sparked my interest. I only noticed the one. Is this in the blown-up portion of the picture or just
well,
the one
actually,
that's on the homepage?
This is in the blown-up portion, but I noticed it first in the blown-up portion, and you can barely see it in the regular one. but I zoomed in on it with Adobe Photoshop.
Okay, well, I don't have that luxury here
well,
with this
computer.
Well,
you can pretty much do it with any Windows Viewer one, but about 30 degrees on the right-hand side, 30 degrees at a northern pattern, you can see another triangle off in the distance.
Okay, it's up a little higher. Is
yes,
that it?
It is.
Well, now, what is that?
That leads, appears to me to be a fighter plane. If you blow it up a little bit more, you can actually see the
All right, so fighter plane either monitoring or following in tandem this triangular-shaped object.
Yes, it is.
See, and we have always believed two theories. One is these are extraterrestrial, or they were military because they're always spotted around military bases. And I'm going to have Lex blow that picture up for me because I see the spot that you're talking about. But the triangular-shaped object looks like it's about five times bigger than the little jet. Would you agree?
That's what made me think that it was a jet and not another triangular-shaped object.
Yeah, you may be right. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Nice job. See, how about that? East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Love your show.
Well, thank you so much.
This is Matt from Orlando.
Yeah, what's going on in Orlando these days?
Not too much, you know. I had a question and a comment about alternative fuels. I was wondering if you'd heard of these engines they have now that they take a thing, they make the, they convert water by splitting up the oxygen and hydrogen. And rather than like having a hydrogen fuel cell, they just break water off, and the exhaust is oxygen, and they just burn the hydrogen from water.
Is this being used anywhere?
I've heard it has been. I've heard that guy, like, I know a lot of the alternative fuel technology they have is just bought up by the companies. And they hide it, and they sit on it. I know they have carburetors that will do amazing things and stuff, but this guy has, like, a public patent on... I think he calls it an ortho-hydrogen, an apparatus for producing ortho-hydrogen. I believe his name was Stephen Chambers.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of him.
Really?
Yeah, I was just watching, by the way, a One Step Beyond show of a guy who was able to drop a little pill into water, and it would turn into fuel, and then he disappeared when they were supposed to have a major demonstration, and nobody ever knew what happened to the guy.
Oh, man.
You know, in hybrids, too, hybrid cars are starting to come out. The problem is they're too expensive right now.
Yeah, and you know, you'd see gas cars that got nearly as good as that mileage in the 70s.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, you'd have to hold on to a hybrid car, they say, 6 years just to pay the difference between what it would cost and what you would save on fuel.
I know, you know, there are cars, you can make a fuel injector or a carburetor that'll get as good a gas mileage just running on gas.
I know. It's almost as if they just don't want to do it.
Yeah, well, they don't, you know. the oil industry and all these people, none of them want to do it.
I know that. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And we are going to do a show. You know, there are two camps out there. One talks about peak oil, where we're going to run out of oil, especially with the way all these industrialized countries are using it. And then there's another theory, and we're going to have a couple guests on. This is fascinating stuff, that we're not talking about fossil fuels, that oil is a natural occurrence. It's part of the planet. And somehow, when you drain, for example, in an oil field, that it fills right back up again, maybe not immediately, but after a couple years, and then you end up getting more. And there are some very, very strange stories about how this is happening. Somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, they were pulling out like 4,000 barrels a day, which is nothing, and then all of a sudden it jumped to 11. It's just, there's something going on in this planet. There's probably more oil that's going to last us a long, long time, but we should not have to rely on it. That's the bigger problem. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hey, George. Hi. My name is James George, and I'm calling you from L.A.
Yes, sir.
And a guy who asked about do blind people dream?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm blind, George, and I do dream.
Now, blind since birth?
No, George. I had the difference of going to school with blind people.
Uh-huh.
I got hurt in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And so I lost my eyesight, but I went to the Foundation for the Junior Blind.
Yeah.
And I've been with many blind students, and sometimes they would wake up and say, man, let me tell you about this dream. And I look and say, how can you dream? And I don't know, you've never seen a dream or never heard of a dream, or you just hear the word.
And they do dream in color,
don't
they?
They do dream in color. Yes, they do. They can describe clothing, shirts, shoes, you know, suits.
Well, here's something funny. I mean, if somebody were to go to you and say, okay, describe red. How do you describe that? How do you describe a color or describe blue? I mean, you might want to say, well, to a blind person, you can't say, well, it's what the sky looks like. They don't know.
It would be very difficult. They have a thing they say, their same scenario. Do anyone know what an orange looks like? And everybody gets the orange in their hand, they feels it, and they feel it and everything, and all of a sudden they get to guessing the color. Well, if I told you that the orange is purple, you would believe that.
Yeah, that's exactly
right.
But
they can't see it, so, you know. And after I became blind, I learned a great deal from blindness. It really taught me, and I was a Marine Corps in the Vietnam War. I was at Quezon.
What exploded?
Mine, the booby trap.
Oh, my God.
It was 265 pounds. It killed us. It seven guys. I'm the only, me and another guy, we're the only two guys alive to tell the story.
In the beginning, I've only got about 30 seconds left, but I have to ask you this. When you were going through this incredible trauma, something that I'm glad I didn't have to go through, to tell you the truth, did you feel as if you weren't going to make it emotionally because you couldn't see anymore?
Oh, most definitely. I was lost. I didn't know what I was, how I was going to live, where I was going to go, what I was going to do, how I was going to live again. All the things I learned in high school, I played professional baseball, I ran track, I was in graduate from high school. I did all these things, and I was just lost. And my teacher was another blind person who taught me how to get around and build my confidence up and how to get going back in society again. And I've been to some of the best blind schools in the United States.
Good for you.
Oh, and it was just fascinating how the mind can absorb so much trauma. And then it could turn that trauma to a positive thing only if you go for it.
Aren't you glad you're still around?
I'm glad just to be alive.
Good
being
for you.
Being blind is no problem. It's just a staying alive.
It's staying
problem.
Alive. That's all our
that's
problem.
All, that's all. And, you know, like, I got hit by a car one time.
Yeah.
And I was walking with my dog, and he hit my dog and killed him.
No, that's right. Hey, I got to run, but you got to call me on one of my full open line shows when we have more time. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about that. Thanks for the call. I'm glad you're doing well. I'll be back in a moment. Dr. Richard Sauter, our guest, as we talk about underground bases and tunnels, next on Coast to Coast AM.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505.